Comics. Comics. Welcome to ORP, otherwise known as Omen Revelations Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Nunley.
And I'm your co-host, Steve Sellers. On ORP, we like to talk about geek stuff, pop culture, including movies and TV series, as well as comic books and comic characters. But that's not all, is it, Mike?
No, it's not, Steve. We're also writers for Omen Comics and Revelation Comics. So we like to talk about both writing and our comics. So podcast and chill with us. Today we're going to be celebrating the 40th anniversary of the cult classic film Blade Runner from 1982. Now I'll be honest, I'm coming to this 40 years late, and yes, I know that is a crime in the court of geek, but I hadn't seen any of the Blade Runner movies until this year. I had a little hype aversion to it for a while, like Steve had with The Matrix. And like Steve ended up feeling about The Matrix, I too wish I had come on a little sooner. I found that Blade Runner kind of snuck up on me with its symbolism and its philosophical questions about sentience, the more I thought about it. But we'll get into our thoughts on it in a bit. But since it was actually your idea to talk about the Blade Runner franchise, Steve, I'm guessing you have a few things to say about that before we get started.
Oh, certainly. Blade Runner was a film that I grew up with, so I probably came in with a different perspective of it. I didn't know what to make of the film at first as a kid, but watching it a few times over the years, I learned to appreciate what the film was trying to say. This is a movie that questions things like what defines humanity and what makes someone human, whether artificial beings can have a soul or truly free will. Not all humans treat others with humanity in this series, and not all replicants act like murdering out-of-control robots. You also eventually see questions that you see later in things like The Matrix, like whether or not replicants are entitled to basic human rights. This is a slow burn kind of a film in the series, really, because it is a cyberpunk noir detective story at the heart of it. But there's a reason this series is considered a classic after 40 years. But let's talk about the basic story of the film. So Rick Deckard, played by Harrison Ford, is a Blade Runner, a cop whose job is to kill or quote-unquote retire replicants that have arrived illegally from the off-world colonies. In this world, replicants are genetically engineered beings who are used as slave labor or as cannon fodder in wars on other planets, and they're basically treated like robots. However, while replicants are stronger than human beings, certain models of replicants only have a four-year lifespan. So one group of replicants led by Roy Batty, played by the great Rutger Hauer, go to Los Angeles to find a way to extend their lives. After being coerced back to the job, Deckard has to track and kill each one of the replicants and retire them. As Batty tracks down his creators in the Tyrell Corporation to try to get them to extend his life. However, the ending of the film puts the shoes on the other foot, with Batty saving Deckard's life just as his own life gives out. Meanwhile, Deckard questions his own identity, leaving the viewer to wonder if he's been a replicant the whole time or not. It's left pretty much ambiguous until the sequel came out in 2017, and you could argue that it's still ambiguous now. This is a film that does a great job of making people think, and it does so long after you've seen the film.
You know what? You're right about it making you think, even after you've seen the film. That is certainly what happened to me. Also, that was a pretty good summation of the story. And actually, speaking of the story, I got to say something about this scene. It just really bugged me. I really didn't like the scene where Deckard forces himself on Rachel. And he even forces her to say that she wants him to do it. This just heavily tarnished my entire perspective of the character. That is some seriously rapey shit. And I don't even see the point of the scene myself, really, other than making you hate him.
Honestly, I tend to block that scene from my memory, so I completely get what you're saying there. Granted that this is a 40-year-old film, and I don't expect it to conform to modern expectations, but even then it comes across as extremely creepy. The scene was awkward for Harrison Ford and Sean Young to make while making it, and that shows on screen, so I could totally understand that reaction. I'm not even sure we really needed that moment in the film, as you could have gotten the point across without Deckard acting like a creep. It's a small blemish on what's otherwise an amazing film.
You know, I actually saw a different version of that scene in the extras on the final cut, where it was much more sensual and less creepy. But as Scott had complete control over the final cut, I have to wonder what he was trying to say by editing that way. I mean, he deliberately chose to put that scene in there like that. But you are right about it being just the one blemish in an otherwise perfect film.
Oh, true. Apparently there was a difference of opinion between the various writers and producers about how explicit they wanted that scene to be and what they wanted to show with it. They just made the wrong choice that time, I think. But let's get into where the story works. I think there was something you wanted to bring up about that, Mike.
Actually, there is, though it's more of a looking back on it after seeing Blade Runner 2049 kind of thing. You know, Blade Runner 2049 really sheds a whole new light on the Eldon Tyrell asking to see the Voight Kampff test fail first by requesting that Deckard give the test to Rachel. Tyrell obviously knew, as Deckard had concluded, that Rachel was a replicant who believed she was a human. Tyrell explains that Rachel is an experiment who has been given false memories to provide an emotional cushion. That experiment must have been in emotions and reproduction. I know we'll get into that in 2049 when we talk about that, but I just had to mention it as we're talking about this. I hadn't really noticed how much 2049 changes your perspective when you watch the first film again.
Oh, yes. 2049 definitely sheds light on certain things, and it offers a new interpretation of events in the first film. I hesitate to call 2049 a full-on retcon, but it does attempt to fill in the blanks to tell its own story. At the same time, it's one that fits with what we're given in the original movie. But yes, it's clear that Tyrell knew a lot more than he was saying, and honestly, I kind of figure that he did. Tyrell did a lot of work in memory modeling and using copies of real memories as a way of building false identities into his replicants. We see in the Blade Runner game that Tyrell typically doesn't make much time for Blade Runners, but he showed a lot of interest in Deckard for some reason. I get the feeling like Tyrell is running the whole situation like some kind of a science experiment, not wanting to say too much because he doesn't want to ruin the results of his tests.
You know, honestly, I can't unsee it that way. It seems so obvious just in the original film that something different was going on there with Tyrell, that meeting Deckard and having him give Rachel the test, it all looks so on purpose and not by chance. As to Blade Runner 2049, I don't think 2049 is a retcon either. You know, in the Reclaiming Characters episode, we talked about how it is preferable that a new writer doesn't change the established continuity, but rather offers a new way of looking at the same evidence. And I think that's what 2049 did. But I apologize. I didn't mean to take us down this big old rabbit hole. This franchise is really easy to do that with.
Oh, very true. I fully expect to go down a number of Matrix-sized rabbit holes before we're through. These films look simple, but they are densely packed with meaning. But why don't we get into the behind-the-scenes process?
That sounds like a good idea. 1982's Blade Runner was directed by the great Ridley Scott, who had just come off the sci-fi horror classic Alien just 3 years prior in 1979. Both films would prove to be seminal cult classics, even though the film's star Harrison Ford and director Ridley Scott did not get along well at all. Despite directing Alien, Ridley Scott was fairly new, at least in America, and Harrison Ford both knew that and had quite a bit of knowledge on filmmaking of his own. Unfortunately, that meant that Harrison Ford questioned Ridley Scott a lot, which must have made things frustrating as hell for Scott, who was trying to get his vision made. Ridley Scott once said that Ford was the biggest pain in the arse he'd ever worked with. But on the flip side of that coin, I imagine it was also quite frustrating for Ford, who felt that he did know a better way. Luckily, they have since patched things up and get along fine now. In 2004, Harrison Ford said this about Ridley Scott: "I admire his work. We had a bit of a patch there, but I'm over it."
Well, it's good to hear they're on better terms these days, though I can understand why they had clashes originally. Ridley Scott is very much an artistic director, and even when he's making genre films, he likes to make very artsy decisions with his films. He's also an extremely visual director who's good at visualizing a scene in his head and has to have the shot exactly a certain way. Because of that, it's not always going to be clear why Scott is staging the scene a certain way until you see it on screen. Harrison Ford is the salt of the earth kind of actor, and he doesn't really think in those terms. Ford also tends to be very outspoken about what he thinks works or doesn't for a movie. For example, he didn't hesitate to criticize George Lucas's dialogue in the original Star Wars. Now, the documentary of the making of Blade Runner goes into more depth, and it offers some interesting details. Harrison Ford was apparently not happy during the production of the film, and at least part of it was because his style of acting didn't click with Scott's style of directing. Ridley Scott would often be working with other actors or focusing on some minute detail of what was in the shot, and not so much on Ford. Ford was used to collaborating with his directors on his character, and Ridley Scott gave him a lot of latitude. I don't think Ford realized at first that Ridley Scott was paying him a compliment, that he gave Ford a lot of room to operate because Ridley Scott respected what Ford brought to the movie and to the character of Deckard. And coming from Ridley Scott, who often micromanaged every single detail of a scene, that is high praise for Harrison Ford as an actor. Eventually, though, I think Ford came to respect Ridley Scott once he understood what he was doing on Blade Runner, and not everyone on the set did. And it could well be that Ford's mood on the set actually made him better as Deckard, who was forced to doing a job he didn't like and was dealing with internal struggles about his own identity.
You know, that's interesting about the tension on set and it affecting Ford's performance. An actor's mood can certainly have an effect on their performance. You know, on Eli Roth's History of Horror, he talks about working with Quentin Tarantino on Inglourious Basterds, on the scene where his character Donnie the Bear Jew Donowitz comes out with a baseball bat and beats that Nazi to death with it. Tarantino delayed filming the scene for days. Roth would get all psyched up to do it, because you'd have to do a scene like that, right? Get all into it. And Quentin would tell him that they would do it the next day, but they didn't do it the next day or the day after that for several days. Roth was genuinely frustrated and pissed when they filmed the scene because of that. Come to find out later that Tarantino did this over and over on purpose because he wanted that kind of raw intensity in the scene. All of that to say, it's at least possible that some of Ford's experience was on purpose because Scott wanted a certain mood and feel. At least, I like to think there's more method to madness with Scott on the Blade Runner set.
Well, emphasis on method acting in this case. Some directors like to play tricks on their actors to get the right reaction of a scene, like the Tarantino example that you're talking about. Now, Ridley Scott would occasionally do the same thing. He kept Sean Young at a distance from the cast and crew because he wanted her performance as Rachel to feel isolated. That comes across in the scenes that we see with her, so it clearly worked for him. It should also be said that Ridley Scott was also very demanding on set, and his perfectionism got him into trouble quite a few times during filming. He would often do something like 30 takes of a particular scene. On the first day, he insisted that the columns in the Tyrell building be turned upside down because he didn't like how it looked in the shot. Ridley Scott started off as a commercial director in England, and his whole approach took some getting used to for the crew working for him. And there were other problems too, like when a leaked newspaper article about Ridley Scott reached the crew and they were all using logo t-shirts to let off steam. There were budgetary problems because the movie went over budget, power struggles between Ridley Scott and the studio behind the scenes, and even failed attempts to fire Ridley Scott as a director. Many people involved in the making of Blade Runner agreed that it was a tough movie to film, but the finished product ended up being more than worth it by the time it was done. But in the end, what makes Ridley Scott a great director also makes him challenging to work for, especially on a tough production like this one.
I think you nailed it on the head there. Scott's eye, attention to detail, and demand for absolute perfection on camera is, like Scott said himself, the reason that the studio hired him. I can't help but think of directors like Hitchcock and Cameron who could be similarly difficult to work with. All the struggle, fights, and difficulties are all worth it in the end when you finally see it on film and see it through the director's eyes. And that's really what most folks that worked on the film say about it ultimately, even if there are some people who quit working on films altogether after working on Blade Runner.
Oh, that's really unfortunate. But at least they ended their careers on a truly outstanding film. Even if they might not see it that way in retrospect.
That is a bummer, and I hope that, like Harrison Ford, they eventually make peace with Scott and all of that. Like you said, they definitely finished on a high note. You know, Harrison Ford was not even the first one the studio thought of to play Deckard. Screenwriter Hampton Fancher envisioned Robert Mitchum as Deckard and even wrote Deckard's dialogue with Mitchum in mind. Director Ridley Scott and Blade Runner's producers spent months discussing the role with Dustin Hoffman. But he actually left the project over differences of vision, which means he could have very well ended up being Deckard had that not happened, which I think would have made it a much completely different movie.
Oh, that's very true. By the time they were in talks to cast Deckard, Robert Meacham was still in good enough shape to play the character, though he was getting on in years. And I could totally understand why Fancher was leaning to Meacham, because he knew film noir very well, and he had the right beaten, weathered look for a hard-boiled and embittered character like Deckard. I think it makes sense to go for someone a bit younger with a different energy to him, but it was a good initial thought. As for Hoffman, he's a great actor, but I have a hard time seeing him in that role. But after two films, I just can't see anybody but Harrison Ford in this role now, much like with Indy and Han Solo.
Oh, I'm with you 100%. Ford alone is Deckard. But according to production documents, several others were actually considered as well, including Gene Hackman, Sean Connery, Jack Nicholson, Paul Newman, Clint Eastwood, Tommy Lee Jones, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Peter Falk, Nick Nolte, Al Pacino, and Burt Reynolds. Honestly, there are some pretty big names on that list, and for Harrison Ford to be chosen out of that group is impressive, even with his performances as Han Solo and Indiana Jones. And actually, after playing those roles, Harrison Ford was looking for a role with more dramatic depth. So when he heard about Blade Runner, he was interested, even if he would only get the role of Rick Deckard in large part because of those other roles. And this goes to show you how well word of mouth and reputation work in Hollywood. Ultimately, the decision was made to cast Ford after talking with Steven Spielberg, who strongly praised Ford's work on Raiders of the Lost Ark. Ironically, it was Ford's collaborative experiences working with Lucas and Spielberg that got him the role that would ultimately be the cause of so many issues between Ford and Scott. But ultimately, Ford got three iconic roles in 5 years, and who else can say that?
Wow. Many great actors can't get three iconic roles in an entire career. Some are lucky to get one. I'll also add that Ford has played one other iconic character after this, Jack Ryan in the Tom Clancy films. Harrison Ford just has this kind of on-screen presence that makes him a great leading man for an action film. Even with his differences of opinion with Ridley Scott, there's no question he got a great performance out of this film.
Ah, oh, Jack Ryan. I feel like a total dork for forgetting that role. Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger are amazing films. I think I maybe forgot about it because others have played that role too. But let's get into the idea where Blade Runner even came from. It turns out that Blade Runner was based on Philip K. Dick's novel Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? While the script was adapted into a screenplay by Hampton Fancher, with later additions and rewrites from David Peoples, they were not the first to try it. My understanding is that producer Herb Joffe optioned it in early 1970s and had his son Robert write the screenplay. However, Philip Dick was unimpressed with and even a little angry about the screenplay written by Herb Joffe's son Robert, saying Joffe's screenplay was so terribly done. Robert flew down to Santa Ana to speak with me about the project, and the first thing I said to him when he got off the plane is, "Shall I beat you up here at the airport, or shall I beat you up back in my apartment?" That sounds like one of those things disguised as a joke, but everybody knows it was in fact very serious. I think this is actually yet another sign that Dick liked the screenplay that by Hampton Fancher with later additions and rewrites from David Peoples. You don't have to take my word for it either. Philip Dick said that after he had finished reading the screenplay Fancher and Peoples had written, he got out his novel, Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, and looked through it and concluded that the two reinforced each other, so that someone who started with the novel would enjoy the movie and someone who started with the movie would enjoy the novel. What's more is that Dick loved the script by Fancher and Peoples, and I think this is pretty cool, actually. Philip Dick said that when he saw the segment of Douglas Trumbull's special effects for Blade Runner on KNBC News, he recognized it immediately. Dick said, "It was my own interior world. They caught it perfectly." He liked the film's script, too, and unfortunately, Philip Dick died before the film's release, but filmmakers dedicated the movie to him. It's not very often that you get that kind of commentary from the original author who when a book is adapted into film. But speaking of Philip Dick, I believe you had some stuff to say on that one too.
Oh, sure. I'd be glad to. I'm a bit surprised that Dick was that kind of the film because it changes a lot of elements. The first Blade Runner film is a very loose adaptation of a Philip Dick novel, using only basic elements from the novel while telling its own story. So you get names in common and certain details of the world in place, like the nuclear war and the fact that animals are artificially made. But the actual story is very different in the film, including some of the characters. Apparently, Hampton Fancher and the producers weren't a fan of the original novel as it was written, and they didn't think it would work as it was written. But Fancher believed in the ideas in the book, and he believed that it would make a great film if done the right way. He turned out to be right big time on that one. I will say that Hollywood seems to love using Philip K. Dick stories as inspiration for films. Philip K. Dick is a writer whose work has been used over and over by Hollywood filmmakers, involving these mind-blowing high concepts that often involve meta-narratives and the questioning of the nature of the self or reality. Odds are, if you're watching a really weird science fiction film, it was probably based on a Philip K. Dick story, especially notable ones like Total Recall or Minority Report. If you think of Philip K. Dick as the Grant Morrison of science fiction writers, that's not too far off. If I remember right, Grant Morrison actually has used his work as an influence in some of his stories as well.
Wow, Total Recall and Minority Report are a couple of favorites of mine as far as sci-fi goes, and apparently Blade Runner makes three. I think 2006's A Scanner Darkly was one of his too.
Yes, it was. But Blade Runner was the adaptation that put Philip K. Dick on the map. While I tend to be for faithful adaptation of books, I think Ridley Scott and Hampton Fancher were probably correct just to use the book as an inspiration for their story, at least in this case. The novel is good. I have read it, but I don't think that it would have worked as a straight adaptation to a film. And it seems that Hampton Fancher felt the same way about it. The structure is pretty simple in the film, and it dives much more in the neo-noir detective side of things. So much of this movie is in the setting and the atmosphere of Blade Runner. So we get a very different story here, but it's one that works for this film, and that may be why Dick felt positively about it.
I think you're right about that. It seemed like he was most impressed with the portrayal of the world that they created. But back to the film itself. You may have noticed that the movie was not called "Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep?" That's because the name for the movie, and I mean just the name, actually came from a cinema treatment from 1974 by William S. Burroughs for Alan E. Nourse's novel called The Blade Runner, which was spelled as one word instead of two. Burroughs had broken it into two words and called it Blade Runner a movie. As I mentioned before, in so many words, the Blade Runner film has nothing to do with Burroughs' screenplay or Nourse's novel. All they took was the name, and which they actually had to get rights for.
Right. That's one of the changes that was made to the original story as well. You will never find a reference to the term Blade Runner anywhere in the original novel. That term was lifted from Burroughs and used as both the title of the movie and a reference to what Rick Deckard does in the film, which is a cop who executes replicants. And honestly, Blade Runner is something that sounds cool, but it doesn't really make a whole lot of sense in the context of the film. I mean, it's not like Deckard uses a blade in the movie, and he doesn't even do a whole lot of running for the most part. But it does sound like an appropriate name for the film, and I think it captures the tone of what the series is, so you can forgive it for taking some liberties.
It does sound cool, but in watching it the first time, I spent the whole movie waiting for them to make sense of why they even call them Blade Runners. Honestly, I think that name could have flopped just as easily with it not making any sense. And speaking of not making a whole lot of sense, I have to say that outside of George Lucas's many re-releases of Star Wars, I have never heard of a movie with as many versions as Blade Runner. I mean, holy crap. There are six versions of Blade Runner. Six. And some of them have different names but are the same film. And let's not forget the version that was only shown once and never heard of again. I will list these versions here in chronological order in an attempt to make sense of all this. There is, of course, the original work print version from 1982 that was 113 minutes long. But in May of that same year, a San Diego sneak preview was shown only once that was almost identical to the US theatrical version that would come out the next month in June. However, this preview version contained three extra scenes not shown in any other version. Do you happen to have any idea what those scenes were, Steve?
Some, but nothing too significant. There was a scene where Roy Batty was established in a vidphone booth. A scene with Deckard reloading his gun after Batty broke his fingers. How he did that, I don't know. And then a scene with voiceover as Deckard and Rachel drive out into the country. The only one I've been able to find is the last one, and it's easy to see why it got cut. Ridley Scott ditched anything with voiceover, and he wasn't in favor of anything that was happy ending related. The other two I don't know about, but I'm guessing they were cut for pacing and time. Some of this is supposition, though, and it's possible there could be more to it.
All right. So, including the 117-minute U.S. theatrical release, a.k.a. the original version or domestic release, we're up to three versions already. But there was also an international release, a.k.a. the Criterion Edition or uncut version, which included more violent action scenes than the U.S. version. This international version was also re-released in 1992 as the 10th Anniversary Edition. But even with all of those names, it's still just one version of the film, and that brings us up to four. Now, coming in at number five, in 1992, we get Ridley Scott's 116-minute director's cut version, a full minute shorter than the theatrical cut. What's more is that Scott's director's cut changed some significant things about the film from the theatrical cut. Things that speak very loudly about the Deckard character, like removing Deckard's voiceover, which Harrison Ford detested anyway, and the reinsertion of Deckard's unicorn sequence, which was important because in Scott's 2007 final cut version, Deckard is a replicant by Scott's own admission, but we'll get into that in a minute. They also took away the happy ending that was in the theatrical cut. As I haven't seen the theatrical version, I have no idea what the happy ending was. Can you shed some light on that, Steve?
Sure, I can help with that. What basically happened with this film is that the studio interfered with Ridley Scott's vision in the theatrical version. There were a bunch of voiceovers from Harrison Ford that were not part of Ridley Scott's plan for the film. The studio basically mandated that Scott put them in the movie. The director's cut removed the voiceovers and added in the dream sequence where Deckard dreams of a unicorn. This ended up hinting strongly at the idea that Deckard was really a replicant the whole time. The final cut is really more of an improvement on the director's cut, changing some of the lighting and the coloring decisions and things like that, but it's fundamentally not that different of a film.
All right. Well, I don't see all of the voiceover scenes. I did see a few, and I couldn't help but be reminded of how my dad used to describe those old Mike Hammer novels. You know, it's like, it's a hard city full of so many dirty secrets and filthy lies that even the constant rain can't wash the filth away, you know, which is kind of what I think of when I think of noir. And in that aspect, I can understand the draw of the voiceover, as it really adds that noir element of the film in a more definitive way. So I think I can appreciate that version for that. That said, I still prefer the final cut, even if I would totally watch the theatrical cut. But what did you think about the voiceover, Steve? I know you watched the theatrical cut originally, so what were your thoughts on it with the voiceovers?
Honestly, I'm not a huge fan of the voiceovers. To be fair, I think Harrison Ford did a good job of doing the hard-boiled detective voice as the narrator, and it is interesting to get Deckard's reaction to the world around him, but I think the film works better without them. A lot of it is telling instead of showing, often unnecessarily so, and I think the film works better when things are more ambiguous and uncertain. This is especially true when you're talking about noir, where so much of the story is about atmosphere and that unsettling feeling where you don't know who to trust. Maltese Falcon didn't have any voiceovers, as an example. Now, the happy ending was also something that was mandated by the studio, so Ridley Scott included it. Basically, there is a scene after Deckard and Rachel leave the apartment for the last time, with the two of them driving out of the city and towards a new future. There's a voiceover with Ford mentioning that Rachel has a normal lifespan and she won't die like the other replicants. But Ridley Scott cut out that scene, choosing to end the movie as Rachel and Deckard leave the apartment. And honestly, I think he was right to end it that way, as it's more ambiguous and it's more satisfying. This is not the kind of film that should have an unambiguous happy ending, although you could read one in if you really want to, but the director's cut and the final cut versions are the cuts that I think truly represent what Ridley Scott's vision for Blade Runner was. Do we want to talk about that a bit, Mike?
Yes, we do, precious. I'm sorry, my Gollum impressions are out of control. But seriously, in 2007, as I mentioned, we got the 117-minute Final Cut version of Blade Runner. They re-released this version in celebration of the 25th anniversary of the original film's release in 1982. The Final Cut is the one I've chosen to be my version, in great part because it's the version of the film I've seen, but also because out of all the versions out there, Ridley Scott retained artistic control over it. And I honestly would always rather have the director's vision of the film, despite there being another version called the director's cut.
Oh, likewise. I think the final cut is closest to how Ridley Scott saw Blade Runner. And I think the studio meddling only made the movie worse. While I'm generally not a fan of tinkering with the film over and over, like with the Star Wars revisions, I'm okay with it in this case because the changes are designed to fix the damage the studio did to the original film. I think the final cut is a better film than the theatrical cut, especially without the voiceovers and the studio-mandated happy ending. I don't think there's much question that Ridley Scott was right on this one, at least for me.
Totally. We're on the same page with that one. I'd like to switch gears, though, and talk about the Roy Batty character from the film. And this will actually be a two-part discussion on Roy Batty and Rutger Hauer. The first part I'd like to talk about is Hauer. One role in the film that was actually not difficult to cast was Rutger Hauer as Roy Batty, the violent yet pensive leader of the replicants. Scott cast Hauer without even having met him, based solely on Hauer's performance in Paul Verhoeven's movies Katie Tipple, Soldier of Orange, and Turkish Delight. But even Philip Dick loved Hauer's portrayal of Batty and said Hauer was the perfect Batty, cold, Aryan, and flawless. Hauer said that out of all the films he's made, Blade Runner is his favorite, but I'm personally torn between Roy Batty and John Ryder from the 1986 horror classic The Hitcher as my favorite roles for him. Where do you stand on that issue, Steve? Is Batty your favorite Hauer role?
Oh, for me, yes. I haven't watched a ton of Rutger Hauer's other films, although I enjoyed films like Lady Hawk and Blind Fury. I also like some of his smaller appearances here and there, like Cardinal Rourke in Sin City, and the small role he played briefly on Buffy. But I think Roy Batty stands as his most impressive role, especially since he contributed a great deal to the character behind the camera as well. There's a charisma and a deep intelligence to Hauer as Roy Batty, and his death scene is one of the best things that Hauer has ever filmed. I think he's right about this role, at least of those that I've seen.
That's certainly a fair take. Roy Batty isn't like any of the other characters I've seen from him, and you listed a couple of good ones there, but that makes Roy Batty and Hauer's performance very memorable. So if I could get to the second part of Roy Batty's question, I wondered about something with Batty watching Blade Runner that I wanted to bounce off of you. When Roy Batty's character was going to die at the end of his lifespan, he seemed to resign himself to it. I say this because he stopped fighting and he grabbed the white dove, a symbol of the Holy Spirit, yes, but here I think it symbolizes the spirit of life within sentient beings. Roy even released the dove when he died. We saw it fly off towards the heavens, and I can't help but think that symbolized Roy Batty's spirit leaving his body. This was again referenced in the animated short Blade Runner Blackout 2022, when the replicant Trixie dies and she falls back to the ground as she's looking up into the sky, and we see the white dove flying up above her. As this movie seems to be riddled with symbolism, I think they're trying to tell us that they have living spirits there.
That's a totally a valid take, and it's clear that Ridley Scott wants us to really think about Roy Batty's doing and why, as well as what it all represents. I'll also add that Rutger Hauer contributes a lot to the scene. The idea of the dove in his hand as he dies, and even the lost in time, like tears and rain line, were both suggested by Hauer. I gained tremendous respect for an already incredible actor when I found out how much he added to the character of Roy Batty. There are so many layers to Roy just within the scene alone. So let's dissect the scene for a bit, because there are different ways to read it. The dove is also a symbol of peace, and I think what Roy does here is make peace both with Deathgard and with his inevitable death. Roy Batty spent so much of this film causing violence to prolong his life, but he's also driven by all of the death and destruction that he's seen as a soldier on the off-world colonies. I think once he realizes that it's too late to save himself, his last act is to save Deckard and make peace with what's left of his life. Maybe it's a final act of defiance of his original programming, with Roy, who is a combat replicant designed to kill, choosing to die on his own terms, choosing life with his last breath. Of course, it's arguable that maybe Roy suspects that Deckard is a replicant, and maybe that's why he saves Deckard at the end, too, his last act of saving one of his own kind. But you could certainly see the dub as a spiritual theme, that there's a spirit even to artificial beings like replicants. The series asks more than once about whether replicants have souls like humans do, so that's a take that's totally fits with those themes.
You know, you just baked my noodle with that comment about Roy choosing to defy his programming and die on his own terms. I think that theory fits in pretty nicely with why Roy would save Deckard, too. Whether or not Roy thought Deckard was a replicant in defiance of programmed purpose and to demonstrate his free will, he chose to save him. I feel like I want to mix that with my spirit theory and say Roy was being his own man there, a free will and an individual spirit. You know, Stan Lee talked about leaving some things ambiguous in his stories just so people would sit around discussing them. I'll be damned if that isn't part of the brilliance of Blade Runner 2.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's a commonality with Philip K. Dick's stories and their adaptations. They leave just enough open to make you think about what they mean without leaving things too ambiguous.
I have to agree with that assessment of Dick's movies. They all definitely have that contemplative ambiguity to them. And honestly, I think that's the key to their enduring quality. One of the big things you're left wondering about with Blade Runner is the nature of replicants. Are they alive? Do they have spirits or a soul? Or in other words, are they sentient? When it comes to this question, I can't help but think of the Measure of the Man episode from the second season of Star Trek The Next Generation. Cyberneticist Bruce Maddox makes a Federation case out of wanting to transfer Data's memories into a computer and dismantle him to better understand the technology that made him. Maddox hopes that this knowledge will allow him to mass produce other androids. Maddox saw Data's personality as programs and algorithms, and his memories, his life experience, as simply ones and zeros, as if he were nothing more than a machine instead of a man. This is another idea that is echoed in the Blade Runner franchise. When in episode 6 of Blade Runner, the chief of police's wife, Josephine Grant, tells the replicant L that she doesn't have real feelings. At the trial to determine Data's right to choose as a sentient being, Maddox gives three prerequisites for sentient life, which are intelligence, self-awareness, and consciousness. Picard says that Data meets two of those three, as he is clearly intelligent and very self-aware as a commander on the Enterprise. However, and this is the sinker, Picard asks anyone in the court to show a means of measuring consciousness, and the court cannot come up with a way. And I don't think that to this day that's a provable thing. But Data was clearly more than just information and programming. As he explained, even his memories were more than just a record of what happened. There was more going on in them than just the fact can provide. They are a part of Data's experience that would be lost, like Roy said, like tears in the rain. But all of that aside, Guinan questioned whether it was moral to even create such a race to begin with, by saying that regardless of whether Data is or isn't a machine, Maddox's plans for reproducing him would lead to a situation tantamount to slavery, creating a slave race of expendable people just like replicants. Guinan's simile was made all the more potent when we see L's story unfold in Blade Runner Black Lotus, when we find out they illegally made a group of replicants who couldn't fight back, mind you, to hunt for sport. If that isn't expendable people, I don't know what is, but we'll talk more about that in Blade Runner Black Lotus episode in part two.
I'm looking forward to getting into that, but I do remember the episode of TNG you're talking about, and it is a classic. But you're right that it fits very well into the same moral issues that Blade Runner wrestles with. The question of whether or not replicants are sentient beings and should be regarded as having rights comes back over and over again. We find out that replicants are treated as little more than slaves, either to do the dirty work that humans won't do, or to die like cannon fodder in wars on other planets, or for sport, as you mentioned. So if you look at replicants as being living beings in the sense that humans are, the parallels pretty much write themselves. At the same time, I think that Dick's original idea is that replicants originally were meant to be inhuman. His idea was that replicants were meant to be essentially sociopaths without conscience or true human feeling. This is why the void comp test works by testing empathy, because someone without a conscience would react differently than a human would by that standard. But in the film universe and its spinoffs, they seem to challenge and change that idea, showing replicants like Rachel and Elle that are capable of empathy. We also see this in the Blade Runner game, where there actually is a civil rights movement for replicants. But as you say, we'll get into those stories later on.
So I have to know about your take on Deckard after the Final Cut release in 2007, but before you watched Blade Runner 2049 in 2017. But before you tell me, hear me out first. I want you to address a couple things specifically with that question. Both producer Michael Dealey and Harrison Ford wanted Deckard to be human, while writer Hampton Fancher preferred the ambiguity of not knowing. But Ridley Scott has stated that in his vision, Deckard is a replicant. So admittedly, even the creators couldn't agree. But I would still like to discuss my theories as a new viewer, and maybe you can offer your perspective when I'm finished explaining.
Sure, absolutely. And we also see that in 2049, Denis Villeneuve presents his own answer to that question. But let's get into that, because the question of Deckard's humanity, or lack thereof, is a pretty big one.
Right. So they talk about how there is basically this group of shared memories that all replicants have that are implants from Tyrell's niece to give them more human responses. Deckard, as a Blade Runner, listed a few of those memories when he was talking to Rachel, but he didn't mention his own recurring unicorn dream from Tyrell's niece. Symbolism is all over this film, and I find it interesting that the dream is a unicorn. The unicorn is a symbol of something unattainable, something you can maybe catch a glimpse of, but never actually get your hands on. Leon, the replicant killed by Rachel, told Deckard that being a replicant, living in fear without a real past or and a limited future, was like having an itch you couldn't scratch. I can't help but think that the itch and the unicorn are a correlation. What's more is they show these unicorns in a couple of places throughout the movie, but most notably as an origami parting gift from Gaff, just as Deckard is about to leave for his new life with Rachel. As Deckard never told anybody about the unicorn, this implies that Gaff knew Deckard had that specific recurring dream. Can you address those two things and maybe offer your two cents on that, Steve?
Oh, sure. Now, keep in mind that the unicorn dream was not in the earlier cuts of the film. That was added back in with the director's cut and the final cut versions, I believe. So some of this is going to depend on which cut you're watching and which you accept as the most canonical. Now, I don't think there's much question that Ridley Scott saw Deckard as a replicant, because the hints are all over the place. The unicorn dream is meant to be someone else's memory. And honestly, I would not be surprised if it's Tyrell's. Tyrell also dreams of something unique, which is the perfection of replicants. Tyrell also seems to take a very deep interest in Deckard, and it's not unlike the interest he takes in his creations, like we see with Rachel and with Roy Boddy. And like all creators, he puts a little bit of himself in his creations to give them life. Beyond that, Deckard consistently ducks the question of whether he ever took the Void Comp test. You can interpret it as Deckard shrugging off what he sees as a dumb question, but you can also see it as Deckard trying to avoid a problematic question that hits too close to the mark. Especially if you accept the final cut version as your preferred version, I think it's clear that the film strongly indicates that Deckard probably is a replicant, even if it's never confirmed. That said, I do think that Blade Runner 2049 complicates the Scott interpretation, but we'll talk about that when we get to that film.
That's interesting. I had not considered that Tyrell could have put his own dream into Deckard. I'm going to have to ponder that one a bit. But what you're saying there certainly makes sense. All in all, though, I thought Blade Runner was a good film, and one I'm going to have to watch several times, really, I think, to take in altogether. I was a little underwhelmed when I initially watched it, but the more I thought about it, the more I started putting stuff together and making connections. Ultimately, I can see why it holds the classic status that it has. I would give Blade Runner, the final cut, a solid 4.5 out of 5. I would have scored it higher had my initial viewing experience been better. But, you know, I brought up the Matrix films earlier in comparison to our experiences, Steve. But I think having layers to dissect and philosophical matters to consider are things the two films have in common. So before we get into the video game, I'd like to hear your pseudo-closing remarks on this 40-year-old classic.
I think I'd agree with that score, honestly. It is a slow burn film, and it takes time setting up its ideas, not to mention that it's a detective film that has to set its clues up methodically. At the same time, I think it presents a unique version of its future for that time, and it's a film that, along with William Gibson's novel Neuromancer, puts cyberpunk on the map as a genre. The atmosphere is so beautifully established with the look of the world and Sid Mead's brilliant designs, as well as the haunting score by Vangelis. I'll also add that Roy Batty is probably Rutger Hauer's all-time greatest performance, at least for me, and the Tears and Rain speech is beautifully done. This is a film that makes you think long after you've seen it, and I think that's why Blade Runner has grown into a science fiction classic over time. It definitely is a film that rewards repeat viewings.
I read some of what the critics have said about the film, and while some of them just didn't get it, and others just didn't like the style, everyone across the board said that it is a visual masterpiece. I went from thinking the film was just okay to not being able to quit thinking about it, to buying the film within a couple of days. I love movies like this, where you get something new from it all the time. But let's get into the video game.
Absolutely. The first real spinoff from the Blade Runner film is the 1997 Blade Runner video game. Now, I'll admit I didn't know about this game myself until the last couple of years. I found the game on GOG, which is short for Good Old Games. It's a PC games platform that is owned by CD Projekt Red, who are best known as the makers of the Witcher games. As far as I know, GOG is the only place you can find the game today, but that version plays pretty well on current PCs. I have played the Blade Runner game, and while it's an old point-and-click adventure game, it does have combat elements, even if it's a bit dated and clunky by today's standards. Still, what this game does well, it does beautifully. The Blade Runner game was made by a company called Westwood, which were at the time best known for making the original Command & Conquer games. Eventually, they were acquired by Electronic Arts, and like many smaller companies bought by EA, they were eventually shut down after a number of poor releases after they were bought. But back when they were independent, Westwood was a very good game company with a great reputation for making games. Now, Westwood at the time was run by a man called Lewis Castle, and he was a huge Blade Runner fan. So much so that he pushed for Westwood to acquire the Blade Runner license and make a game of it. He already had ideas in mind and a pretty strong pitch, which he made to the Blade Runner partnership, who held the rights to the movie. A number of companies made pitches to the Blade Runner partnership for a Blade Runner game, including the aforementioned EA. According to Castle, who spoke in length about the process of making the game, the Blade Runner partnership told him that Westwood got approval because they had such a good pitch in mind for the game. So Blade Runner the game is a very good game by the standards of 1997. And it's still a pretty decent game, even 25 years later, which is impressive. The visual style of the movie is replicated perfectly, up to and including many recognizable sets used in the film and the cityscapes. If you put the game footage side by side with the film, you will notice very few real differences. And in 1997, that is really astounding. The game also used the Vangelis score, as well as a number of the original actors providing voice work on it, including Joe Turkel as Eldon Tyrell, James Hong as Mr. Chu, and even Sean Young as Rachel Rosen. Now, the story features a different Blade Runner named Ray McCoy as he solves various replicant-related crimes throughout Los Angeles. The first crime you investigate is the murder of animals, real ones, in a pet shop by a pair of replicants. That investigation leads you to interacting with characters from the original game, as well as new characters and familiar locations. The game is best described as kind of a sequel to the first Blade Runner, much like End of the Matrix was for The Matrix. And it takes place roughly within the same time frame as the original film. There are very loose references to Deckard, though you don't meet him. But what the Westwood game really does do well is explore the themes and ideas of the original film. You have many different options of how to investigate and how to deal with the replicants. Now, everything you do has repercussions, and you can either kill everyone you meet, or you can try to talk your way out of the situation. You have no idea who the replicants are from playthrough to playthrough, either, because the game randomizes it up every single time. So you need to use the void conf test to figure out if someone you meet is really a replicant or not. You also have to use the computer to get new clues from photographs you find, just like Decker does in the original film. Along the way, you deal with police corruption, the question of whether replicants are entitled to civil rights or if they're just machines, and even the morality of whether it's right to retire these replicants or if what the replicants are doing is morally justified.
You know, I found it interesting that they use the term retire instead of kill. It's a way that, humans detach themselves from horrors they don't want to face. It's the same reason we change the names of our food. Like we don't order or buy cows. We call it hamburger or steak. It's not deer. It's venison. It's not killing. It's retiring.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. In order to justify committing violence on a group of people like this, they first have to redefine the language so that it sounds socially acceptable. So Blade Runners are not acting as executioners on a second-class citizenry. They are retiring rogue machines from service. We've unfortunately seen this kind of thing more than once in history, and it leads to tragic outcomes every time it happens. But let's get to happier topics and back to the game itself and how it turns the shoe on the other foot. Now, the game puts McCoy on the defensive after a while, as he's accused of being a replicant, and then he has to defend himself from the charges. That opens all sorts of interesting questions as you play. Is McCoy really a replicant, and has his entire life been a lie? Or are the corrupt cops just trying to gaslight him so that they can justify murdering McCoy legally to cover up their own dirty business? The game makes you doubt whether McCoy is a replicant or not, much like with Deckard, but that has worked out differently in the game. The answer to that question in the game completely depends on your actions as McCoy. If you act inhumanly and use excessive violence to solve your problems, then by the end, you're a replicant. If you play it by the book, if you kill the replicants, legally and don't retire any humans by mistake, show empathy at the right times, then McCoy is a human. Because of that, you get many different possible endings. And even though the game is short, the numerous options make the game extremely replayable. The game also does well at using the same kind of themes and symbolism as the film. And it expands the lore in a way that makes you really think about the moral implications of your actions. Also, as an aside, using the name McCoy for your Blade Runner character is sheer genius. Throughout the whole game, you're trying to figure out if your character is, in fact, the real McCoy. That is just really clever, and I think fitting to what Ridley Scott's vision was. On a narrative and storytelling level, in terms of the graphics, sound, and fidelity to the film, the Blade Runner game is outstanding. And it's jaw-droppingly good for 1997 software. This game is better than Enter the Matrix for me in a lot of ways. While doing some of the same kind of things the game tried to do, despite having some coming out years earlier on older hardware, even with some of its clunkier elements, I'm still impressed by this game. Definitely play it if you can find it.
That does sound like a lot of fun, and I do love the choose-your-own-adventure style of gameplay that you're describing there. I can see myself playing it over and over again until I do every option like I used to do poring over those old choose-your-own-adventure books. But that about wraps up the first part of our celebration of Blade Runner's 40th anniversary. But we won't keep you waiting long on part two. We'll actually see you tomorrow as we talk about Blade Runner 2049 and the 13-part series Blade Runner Black Lotus. But until next time, we want to say thank you to our patrons who make this podcast possible. I hope you've had fun hanging out with us today on ORP. I know that Steve and I have had fun making this episode. If you've had fun too, we invite you to share this episode and help us get the word out.
For our Spotify listeners, we ask you to please rate our show as well. That can really help to grow our audience. But to all our listeners everywhere, we want to say thank you for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks.